Hello, this is Theatre Voice. I'm Dominic Cavendish. With me are David Benedict, Rhoda Koenig and Mark Shenton. Critical opinion about Mourning Becomes Electra has tended to be fiercely divided. When Eugene O'Neill's epic play was first produced in 1931, his reworking of the Oresteia and its attendant myths, transposing the House of Atreus's cycle of familial bloodshed to a New England setting at the close of the American Civil War, provoked a range of responses. In The New Republic, the critic Stark Young suggested, Mr. O'Neill has come to what is so rare in Northern art, an understanding of the depth and subtlety that lie in repetition and variation on the same design. By contrast, Robert Benchley in The New Yorker amused himself at the expense of the work's creaky melodramatics. Mourning Becomes Electra is just the old Greek story put into not particularly convincing New England talk. Willing, as the spirit may be, to take punishment, he wrote, referring to the play's near five-hour length, the human frame is not equipped for such a session. And so the debate has sputtered on. Eric Bentley in 1952 complained, the more he attempts, the less he achieves. O'Neill has never learnt his lesson. The idea of big work lured him out into territory where his sensibility is entirely inoperative. And then again, a few years later, George Steiner placed himself firmly in the anti-O'Neill camp in The Death of Tragedy, where he denounced the playwright for committing inner vandalism by sheer inadequacy of style. Rarely seen on these shores, what's remarkable about Howard Davies' current revival at the National is how critics have generally lined up to salute a marathon evening. Accolades have been showered on the principals, Helen Mirren as Christine Mannon, the murderous Clytemnestra-like matriarch who dreads the return home of her brigadier husband and has taken up with a young captain in his stead, Eve Best as her vengeful daughter Lavinia, and Paul Hilton as her morbid brother Orin, a latter-day Electra and Orestes to those in the know. David Benedict, the first question I really wanted to ask was, what was your response to this play? Did you feel exhilarated or merely exhausted?
Well, I've always sort of agreed with Mary McCarthy, just to add one more critical voice to the list you've just done, where she describes O'Neill's work as the logical symphony of a tone-deaf musician. I mean, there is everything wrong with O'Neill's writing. It's monolithic and huge and convinced of its own importance and yet it works. In a production like this, which is not flawless, but it's pretty damn good, it actually does take you over. I mean, there's a moment right towards the end of the play where Eve Best's character, Vinny, lets slip what she really thinks. Now, we've known this for the previous 4.25 hours, but the letting slip of it is a dramatic moment, and the person 2 seats away from me literally gasped aloud, and the whole audience, you could feel, was leaning in at this moment, and you think, we've been in the theatre for 4.25 hours, we're that glued to the action that moment is resonating. Something got done right. I think this production is pretty extraordinary.
Well, I suppose by contrast, you could say that the audience have been so sort of muddle-headed throughout that just seizing on something like that rather late in the day is a testament to the production's inability to...
They were too quiet beforehand. Yeah, the audience went with this.
Yeah. Mark Shenton, did you find this a surprise, a neglected masterpiece even?
Well, it's certainly overwrought and overwritten and hokey and melodramatic. But again, like David, I think it's staged with such utter conviction that it makes for an enormously powerful evening in the theatre. The production is just so riveting.
So it seems to be a case of a play with faults but a fantastic production. Is that your stance on this, Rhoda Koenig?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a play with flaws. You could say the whole play is a flaw. I mean, O'Neill is one of these great writers who doesn't write very well. They're like Gissing or Dreiser, but he is a very great man nevertheless. And this is a great play not only for what it is on its own terms, but for its opposition to not just the theater, but the society of the present day. Because the this has always been the difference between America and England. America is the country with no tragic sense. America is the place where you want something, you go and buy it. You want to become something else, you acquire a new personality. And in England, England is very much sadly in danger of losing the tragic sense which has always informed its art. The the unbridgeable distance between one's desires and one's ability to achieve them. And you know, we now have this terrible society that says, go, buy this, buy that, do this, do that. You don't like this life change you've made? Huh, get rid of your life and get another one 5 minutes later. And this place says, look, what your mother and father were, and what your grandmothers and grandfathers were, and what the place where you grew up, and the place where you live is, and the people you live with, that's you, and you're not going to get away from it.
Well, I'm intrigued that you see it as a timely reminder for our own concerns, but I couldn't see it addressing society at large as a piece of writing. It seems to be an incredibly enclosed play in the way that. You know, it seems to feed in on itself.
Well, I think it is, you know, it is, in addition to what Rhoda says, it's a profoundly American play, in that the criticism of American plays is that they are too domestic. They write great family plays. This is a great family play. Mm. But like Rhoda, I think this does, you spiral out from there. The concentration on the family is so intense, and it is a metaphor for a much larger society.
It's about the family of men.
It is, you know, all these things are being passed down. I mean, one of the extraordinary things about Eve Best's performance is the way in which she physically becomes more and more like Helen Mirren. I mean, you know, they are two very dissimilar women. They start off physically utterly opposed in the way that they've been directed. They look different, they move differently, and yet somehow, by osmosis, as the daughter acquires the characteristics of her erring mother, in many ways, she physically becomes her. I think it's one of the, you know, it's an extraordinarily double act.
The son, too. The son also becomes the father. And in fact, in the Glasgow production, which I didn't see in 1991, the same actor played both parts, fascinatingly.
But also, the other thing about the play is, it's a big mistake to take the characters at their own valuation, because the characters all have an explanation of why they're the way they are, but that doesn't mean you have to believe them. I mean, the daughter hates the mother because she does such and such, and the mother says that she treats the daughter in such a hateful way because of such and such and such. That's our story. Yeah, but there are other explanations equally or indeed more convincing. And this is a play not only about people who are doomed to a certain end, but who are blinded about their own motives as they stagger toward that end.
I certainly agree with you that the play cracks open the sort of nasty hive of animosities that are contained in many families. But for me, your assertion that there are these kind of the complexities in the character, I find in some ways difficult to credit, because I agree that what the characters say about themselves doesn't really stack up necessarily with their own motives or their own particular actions. But really, the underlying thrust of the play is to suggest that there are these very basic sexual jealousies at work. You know, the daughter resents mother, not necessarily because she really cares that much about her father, but because in some way she resents the lover that the mother's taken up with. These are crude approximations of kind of Freudian psychology, and that's been pointed out, I suppose, by those who sit in the kind of anti-O'Neill camp. Do you feel really that there is a great deal of complexity in
these
characters?
I think all those, you know, all the sexual jealousies and the sexual tensions, etc., that's what motors the plot. That's what keeps you watching. I mean, somebody somewhere accused it of being little more than a soap opera. Well, that's true. You know, the people are doing extraordinarily selfish things to do with their lusts and who wants to sleep with who, etc., etc., in the way that contemporary soap opera does. I would argue that this play does it with a certain amount of kind of belligerent majesty. I mean, it's drenched in kind of this passionate tension that keeps you glued to it. And the best of the performances have a kind of tension within them. Eve Best manages to suggest one thing whilst saying and doing another nearly the whole night long, which is really, really difficult to do. I mean, there is so much texture in her performance, and also particularly in Paul Hilton and Helen Mirren, but also in little roles like Rebecca Johnson, who plays the sister-in-law to be. She's this little light-headed girl who sort of knows no better, but you begin to see her understanding, and it's a kind of pin-sharp portrait of the woman that she has to be, and also the woman that she's slowly becoming as she begins to understand what's going on. I think it's much more complex than you are giving it credit for.
Well, also, this is an important point. Don't forget, though I didn't see it noted in any of the reviews I read, that this is the condensed version. There's been more than an hour cut from it, and if I, which is a shame because I would like to see the original in its entirety.
A friend of mine told me about a fringe production of the Tabard Theatre, which did all three plays, because it is actually written as three separate plays, and did, and in fact they staged trilogy Saturdays. You could see them on separate nights, all in one go. But what's interesting, I think, about the play is that there are no subplots. It's all one huge narrative, all propelling remorselessly down. I said it was overwritten, but it's also incredibly claustrophobic, so tightly realised in this production, even though there's this huge set, but which constantly takes different shapes, and finally encloses the Eve Best character right at the end.
I mean, it pulls off this really clever stunt. It's like Cary Grant and the crop spraying sequence in North by Northwest, where Hitchcock gets claustrophobia in a completely open space. Bob Crowley sets up this enormous veranda on one side of the stage that sort of disappears off to a vanishing point upstage left, and you've got this huge expanse of stage, but the hard angles of Mark Henderson's lighting gives you this strange sense of doom and gloom, and it feels very, very tight, although you've got virtually the whole of the Littleton stage open, which create a certain amount of problems kind of sonically or orally rather, and some of the voices get lost because there's nothing against which their voices can bounce, so it takes a while to kind of key in because of that. But he does that, and then you get all these interior scenes with steeply angled walls, and it absolutely gives you that sense of claustrophobia. And then finally there's a huge coup de théâtre where the whole set changes inexorably into the ship, which you really do not see coming. You think, oh, this is going to be one of those productions where they just move the set from side to side and you know what's happening, and then suddenly this thing happens.
A moment straight out of Night's the Night, in fact, where...
Well, I have to say that it was at that moment that my all my misgivings about the productions reached a red alert, because, you know, when an audience is applauding the descent of a cracked ceiling, which turns into, as you say, a sort of ship's deck, and that itself becomes a kind of highlight of the evening for some people, clearly.
I think you're being honest.
Well,
it doesn't mean it's bad. It just means that there are a lot of set applauders in the audience. You know, I don't applaud a set, but some people do. It doesn't say one way or t'other about whether the play is good or not.
Well, it just seemed to be unnecessary. It seemed to be, and a lot of the scene changes had this ponderousness, you know, with a sort of all these kind of stagehands moving on and off to whisk the odd bit of furniture here and there. It had a stateliness that just, in a sense, added to this quality of, I mean, we're watching a serious monumental event, but for me, it's an act of being about a sort of focus.
I have to say that although, for the most part, I'd say about 80%, I'd say the set was 80% really good, but I didn't see the point of that dinky little toy town village off to the off on stage right beyond the veranda. I mean, it looked like some half-finished Christmas creche, and I didn't understand why the ceiling of the veranda was a faded and ripped and tattered American flag. I mean, is that supposed to be some kind of symbol to show that the United States or capitalism is corrupt and rotten? I mean, they just won the war. You know, they're riding high. They're on the biggest crest of prosperity the world had ever seen in the northern United States after the Civil War. So I don't know what that flag is. It's just silly. But the huge size of the set and those frightening angles, that was good. That was very good.
Let's just quickly sort of go around the table asking about what you think O'Neill has done that has changed or enhanced Aeschylus, because, you know, one of the the praising comments that have been made here suggest that really, you know, O'Neill has created this powerful, tense plot, and it's all very claustrophobic, and it leads to these inexorable tragic conclusions. But of course, this is really the Aeschylean model, and you know, Eric Bentley argued quite forcefully that, in a sense, the creative work had already been done by the kind of Greek master, and that in effect O'Neill was kind of hijacking this kind of fantastic plot, this fantastic story, which in a way already says so much about the family, about these relationships. What does he add? What is it really, finally, that O'Neill adds to this Greek story, do you think?
Well, it makes it real for us. I mean, it's very... It can be very impressive to see a Greek tragedy, but when you come right down to it, you know, this man kills his daughter because he believes that if he doesn't, the wind won't blow. You know, what is that? If it's things that really motivate people, 150 years ago or today, you know, sex, revenge, jealousy. Then it makes it real for us. I mean, I would hardly say it's stealing somebody else's clothes, because it's so changed in the adaptation that it's a completely different trilogy. I think Eric Bentley's crazy.
I think you've got a point there. I mean, you know, loads of people have done versions, adaptations of each other's texts, and either it works or it doesn't. And for me, this absolutely did work. I didn't expect it to. As I say, I'm not an O'Neill fan, but there is a conviction about this production that absolutely holds you to your seat. And also, I just would quite like to say, everyone's going, oh my god, it's 4.5 hours, like it's this endurance text. I mean, one, it's gripping, but also there's an interval every 75 minutes. I mean, it's really not that hard to watch. It's not like, oh well, I must gird my loins and go to the theatre.
Well, I thought it felt to me as if I was sitting there about 2.75 hours. That was what it felt like to me, not 4.75.
Absolutely. Well, the thing I was going to say that O'Neill added was running time, because it is much longer than the Greek plays. But
I'm the oik that sits there in the Oresteia going, well, he blew all his good gags in the first hour. You know, the first part of the Oresteia is absolutely gripping, but you know, it sort of pays diminishing returns. It becomes more and more philosophical, whereas actually the narrative screw in Morning Becomes Electric tightens and tightens and tightens until you're left with this devastating final image.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Until they are tightens.
So it really sounds as though you're saying that this is a kind of a piece of work to which more attention should be paid, and we should probably be reviving this.
You're really saying I don't want to see it in a bad production. I really don't want to see this in a bad production. It would be unendurable.
Well, look, you're saying we have a superfluity of serious plays. Come on. I mean, Eugene O'Neill is the greatest playwright of the 20th century in America. And, you know, when you look at the British theater, hey, come on, you know, it was no British playwright created the 20th century theater. You had to have Shaw come over from Ireland to do that here, and Ibsen, a Norwegian, you know? So, come on, you can let me know a great tragic American in here too, you know?
Quickly, rustling up some support for some of the other players on the in this production. Paul Hilton has been particularly singled out for praise. Do you think that his Orin, as you say, a kind of masterly performance?
I do. It's one of those roles that could be quite horribly overplayed. Adam Godley is currently in The Pillow Man, and it's sort of they're both similar types of performance. They're very, very restrained in roles that could be completely overcooked. You could get these sort of awful attention-seeking neurasthenic performances of tragic victims, and both those actors in both those plays are absolutely holding back, and actually they're playing the scene, they're playing what is necessary, not indulging in an awful lot of elaborate, painful victim character work.
I thought would like to make a plea for Tim Pigott-Smith, who I thought was particularly notable as well.
Wonderful.
He's not an actor I normally liked, but on this occasion I thought he was really remarkable.
Mm. Well, Helen Mirren, now, it is true that the sets, although very big, give a feeling of claustrophobia. Nevertheless, you're very aware that stage is enormous, and it has those ludicrous... this is Cinerama proportions, and the actors on the whole, though they're quite good, I felt they're just not big enough. They're not heavy enough. They don't carry enough weight. And I felt that particularly with Helen Mirren. She's very charming. She's very seductive. She's very funny. She's very subtle. But she doesn't have a big voice and a big presence. And this is a play for which you need almost 19th century type actors, you know, barnstormers.
I suspect that may come. I would give that the benefit of the doubt. I think that it didn't have that many previews. I mean, you know, you're basically rehearsing three plays at once. This takes time. I suspect that the performers will grow and grow. I also think it's worth pointing out that we never remember what a good comedienne Helen Mirren is. She was fantastic some years back in A Month in the Country at the Albury Theatre, and there are moments of sublime humour where she just flashes a look, as you know, a kind of scepticism at what her daughter's wittering on about. And there's a moment where she says, "Oh, for God's sake, stop talking!" And actually, in a less good production, one would sense the entire audience going, "Oh, yeah," and the rest.
There are a few moments when she reminded me of Zoe Wanamaker, actually, and that was the comedy that she was. She had the same sense.
Eye rolling.
Sure. One thing I have to say. This sounds silly or trivial, but it's part of a bigger point. One thing that was terribly wrong was the women's underwear. Every time one of them swung around, you saw this skirt right up to the knee, and you could see bare legs under the skirt. That is so wrong. You know, these women then were, you know, they walked around in cages. They had tight steel-boned corsets. Silly mistake. Of course, it's New England, it'll be whalebone. they had whalebone corsets. They wore half a dozen stiff, hard-as-iron petticoats, and if they thought that a man was going to see their calf, much less their knee, they would have fainted with shame. And now that's part to me of a greater flaw, which is I thought the movement, the demeanor of the actors was much, much too modern. I mean, there's a man talking to Helen Mirren on the day of her husband's funeral, and he's slouching with his hands in his pockets. That's terrible. The people do not behave remotely like 19th century New England Puritans. And the problem with that, now, I'm sure that's the director's intention. He wants it to seem modern for us. He doesn't want it to seem peculiar. He wants it to, you know, be swift and, you know, really cutting. But I think when you do that, then you reduce the play just to the struggle between the characters, and you lose the sense of the struggle that the characters have with themselves, which is an especially strong point considering that today, oh, if it feels good, do it. Oh, she's screwing this one, she's screwing that one. If she's having a good time, fine, great, so what? These people are boiling with passion, and they are going against what, you know, what their whole lives have told them is decent and right. And to me, you get no more of a sense of that from this performance, not much more anyway, than you would watching modern day people.
That almost brings me to my next point, really, which is that there's been an admission, I suppose, that O'Neill, great as he is, can be flawed in his writing. And one of the lines that continues to haunt me was this line of Lavinia describing Orin. It's the same thing, what the war did to him, and on top of that, father's death and the shock of mother's suicide. You know, the question is, could you actually create a period faithful account of this work, do you think, in which a lot of that language was tidied up and made less obvious than it strikes us today.
Yeah, but don't forget, when she's saying that, she's lying.
You know, it is clear. I mean, Ezra at one point says, "You made me appear a lustful beast in my own eyes." You know, as again, I'm afraid to repeat myself, Mary McCarthy says, you know, he has a tin ear for dialogue. He doesn't write that kind of dialogue, and certainly not dialogue that we recognise now. However, the effect of it, the cumulative effect, I think overrides what we would regard as clunking, difficult dialogue. And actually, it sort of becomes immaterial. Yes, you can take it apart line by line and go and look at all the things that it doesn't do with any degree of felicity, but I kind of want to say, so what?
You look at what Mary McCarthy lacked, the woman who could see through everything and therefore could see nothing.
Well, we'll leave it be there. Thank you very much, Rhoda Koenig, David Benedict and Mark Shenton.